Good evening, everybody. My name is Chuck, and I am alcoholic. And I want to thank my dear friend Troy for inviting me back to Salt Lake City. I haven't been here in a long, long time. I want to welcome you home if you are new to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're one of the people that raised your hand, and if you're one of the people who didn't want to raise their hand, who really felt it was nobody's business when you had your last drink. You're my kind of alcoholic. I'm glad to be back. The first time I ever went out of town to do anything like this was, it's been probably about 5 or 6 years ago, and the first time I ever left town was to come to Salt Lake City, a place called Bountiful. You guys remember where that's at? And it's no vision for you. anyway, so I get off this plane. You know, this is a weird thing. This is a strange part of AA. And they asked me to come, and I'm on the plane. I get off the plane, and it's kind of weird doing this stuff because I'm a drunk. I'm just a puking drunk. That's all I am. There's nobody special here tonight. There's nothing special about me. I'm a guy that was dying of alcoholism for years and came to Alcoholics Anonymous and drank in between meetings and drank after meetings and came to meetings drunk and hated you all and couldn't get sober. And something happened to me on June the 14th, 1993. I was given grace. I was given a willingness that I didn't produce. And I got around people, and I've been doing this thing for a long time. There's nothing special about me at all. What's special is about that power. But doing this kind of stuff is a little strange. And I get into Salt Lake City. It's the first time I've ever done this. I'm terrified. I don't know what I'm going to say, what I'm going to do. I don't know anybody there. Some guy had like canceled last minute at some function in Bountiful, and one of the guys that walks up to me is a diesel mechanic. The guy weighs about 300 pounds, and he's covered in grease and bib overalls, and he has hands the size of watermelons, and he comes up and he says, "Where's your pal?" And he mentions this guy's name, and I said, "I don't know. They just asked me to." He goes, "Oh, so they sent you instead?" And I went, "Well, yeah, they called me like 2 days ago, and we got a flight, and I'm here." And he says, "I'm going to tell you one time, pal, and one time only. You better be good." So I have great memories of Salt Lake City and the welcome. So I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. Hopeless variety. And I love to come to a group where they talk about the concepts and the traditions. They're very, very important. If you're new tonight and you're like me, I've always wondered and I've always been kind of pissed off when they talked about the traditions or anything else because it takes time away from more important topics like me. But I love it because the purpose of that is so we stay together as a group. So there's something here to pass on as a lineage. So the alcoholic coming in. So if my grandson ever needs this, that it'll be here the way that I got it without being diluted and run down and I won't use that language, but changed. I love the third tradition. We start my home group's called the Sunset Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're a big book-based group out of Studio City, California. And we have a preamble that reads like yours in some way. It says that everyone's welcome here, but our participation is limited to those who suffer from alcoholism per the third tradition long form. And if your problem is something other than alcoholism, you're welcome in Alcoholics Anonymous. However, participation here is limited to alcoholics only because of the traditions. And it's not to keep anybody out or to be rude. It's not to not make it inclusive. But it's really important for alcoholics to talk alcohol and alcoholism as it would be at another 12-step program to talk about what that suffers. And how that boils down is this, and I don't want to get on traditions, but I have the experience of picking people up and going from treatment centers to meetings, and I had the experience of sitting in a car with a guy who's in his 60s who drank vodka every day, never lost a home, has a stock portfolio, beautiful home, his wife left. He's lost a lot of stuff in life, but he's got a lot going on still. Very bright. And he's dying of alcoholism, drinking himself to death every day and pissing his life away. And he comes to us for help, and we take him to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings through treatment center. And we come to a meeting, and the guy at the podium the entire night talks about things that this man cannot relate to. And the guy reached his hand out for help because he was told to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he came here, and he heard nothing about his problem. And when he got in the car, he had this sad, depressed look on his face. Like the book says, the doors of hell had closed with a clang. And he looks at me and I said, what's wrong, Gaylord? He says, well, I don't think I don't think this is going to work for me. I thought Alcoholics Anonymous might be able to help. But I don't know anything about slamming stuff and going to prison and robbing people. And I thought there was something here. Because Alcoholics Anonymous is, in many places, has deviated from our traditions, unfortunately. I don't want to soapbox, but it's just the way it is. And it's important to be in a group like this. If you're new, welcome home to a pocket of enthusiasm. Welcome home to where this is, where you're going to hear Alcoholics Anonymous, I hope. And I'm a hopeless variety alcoholic. I'm the alcoholic the book talks about. Hopeless, the word hopeless. I like the term alkalese. Alkalese is the language we developed from the dictionary that's not really there. And alkalese, to me, the word hopeless means this. Now, is it without hope? Is it? Yeah, that's true. But for me, what it really means is this. It means I desperately want to stop, and I can't. Hopeless. It's not the Skid Row guy. It could be the Skid Row guy. It could be a lot. But for me, it's I really, really want to stop this, and I can't. And if you're new tonight and that is your condition, welcome home. We have an answer here. Welcome home to magic. Welcome home to a way out. Welcome home to the mothership. I grew up in a small town in central California outside of a place called Fresno, a little town called Tulare. It's a farming town. You can smell it before you get to it. I'm the oldest of three, and I'm thirsty. I'm going to get cotton mouth. Remember cotton mouth? Some of you remember cotton mouth. And I grew up in a small town. I'm the oldest of three. My mom and dad were very poor growing up. They didn't have very much going on. They were very, very poor. They had nothing, and they educated themselves and gave me every opportunity. And my sisters that they didn't have, but it's not enough for me. I have a sense of entitlement. I have a sense you owe me. Nothing you give me is ever enough, and you don't love me right. I was growing up in this small little town, not good at anything. I'm not good in sports. I'm not associate. I am not a jock. I don't understand sports. I am not a team sport guy. I snowboard. I play guitar. I ride mountain bikes. I'm not into baseball, football, soccer. If you are, terrific. I'm more into Iron Maiden, dude, or Judas Priest. I'm one of those kind of guys. You're here. I see you. And if you're like that, if you're not good at sports, you're not good in school, you're not smart, you're not a good-looking kid, you don't have money, you end up like me, you end up with an elite crowd called stoners. Hands, you're out there? Yeah. And that's where I ended up with, the stoners. Because the stoners have no requirements. I fit there. I don't. Really? They don't. Can you steal is one of their qualifications, you know. Can you lie? Can you cheat? Gotcha. Here we go. And in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, what's unique about this is the fact that I grew up like this. I grew up with these feelings of anxious apartness. I grew up with a hole in my soul that I couldn't touch with anything. I grew up with this sense of not fitting. Our book describes it as restlessness. I can't seem to find where I fit. With these feelings of irritability, I'm easily agitated. Some of you might relate. Go to the store and there's that express line. Are you a counter? I'm a counter. And discontentedness. Discontentedness. No matter what I get, no matter what I achieve, whatever I earn, it's never enough. It's never the right one. It's always, always something else just over there. And I live in a world where I'm never even present. I'm always in my head. I'm either worried, remorseful, self-pitying about whatever I've been doing to people around me, or I am plotting and planning against the stuff that's going to happen tomorrow because the fear is overwhelming when you live in my skin. And I hung out with these stoner guys. I didn't know why they called us stoners, but I hung out with these guys and acted cool, acted stone. I didn't know what it meant to be stone. I don't have brothers or anybody around me like that. I never saw alcohol consumed in my home. My mom and dad are not drunks. But I was at a junior high school at a dance when I was a kid, and I always wanted to ask girls to dance. I never had the courage to do what you guys do that have that courage. But I knew that if I drank, alcohol would help me. And at a wedding, I saw alcohol there, and there was a live band, and I drank because I could fit in and I could do what you do. I could be a man. And I took a drink. I didn't like the flavor of the stuff. It was called Cold Duck. That was the champagne at this fine event, and red wine, which tasted awful to me. I didn't like the flavor, but I knew if I got it down, it would do something. I had some uncles that used to come over drunk, and they were always very, very happy and animated. They had their cheeks got rosy red, you know, and they were happy. And I took those drinks, I started to drink, and as I started to drink, it started to do something to me. And what it did for me, for an alcoholic of my type, you know. You already know what it did. The book talks about this. It talks about that I really can't put my finger on what it does. The sensation is so elusive. It's so elusive. What it did for me, it's different for a lot of people, but what it did for me was I felt like for the first time I could take a really deep breath. And I could relax. And my friend says it best. He said, it's a nerd remover. I feel like a nerd and I drink and I'm not a nerd anymore. I feel like a nerd and I drink and another drink and you're the nerd. I feel like a nerd and I drink and you're all pretty lucky I'm even here. And there's a lady, I love it. In L.A., there's a gal named Mary, says it best. She says that when she drank, she became prettier, wittier, and tittier. That is an entire psychic change. And that's what my sponsor is. I just adore this guy. He's taught me so much. But I love the way he describes this. And what he says is, Chuck, for the first time in your life, at the age of 13, alcohol effectively relieved you of the bondage of you. Alcohol let the curtain come down that you were behind. It just all fell to the ground, and there was nothing in between you and I. And I'm at one with everybody. I'm okay with everything. I have the experience. I don't know if you do. I have the experience of walking into a function that's social, and I get into the room. It's work, family. I start looking around the room. I don't want to be there. I want to stay home. And I start looking at people, and I start to build cases against people. Oh, she's a brown nose. And look at him, Mr. Know-it-all. And I just start to do this. And I don't want to be there. I hate everybody. And I start to drink. And immediately, I love you, man. You know, you give me a little cocaine, I want to start a business with you. You know? Yeah. And alcohol has a tremendous effect on some. Alcohol, as Clancy talks about, those of you who might have came to hear Clancy, I'm not going to quote him tonight, but I will say this, that it changes my perception of reality. It changes the perception. That doesn't happen for my mother or for my non-alcoholic sister. They have a different reaction when they drink versus the one that I have. They have a sense that the picture is getting fuzzier and losing control. I drink, and it gets HD. It gets clear, and I get seamless of purpose. Let's drink more. And when you're like me and you can get that from a drink, you'll drink every chance you get. I went to my first meeting at 15 and a half years old on a court card through courts. I was arrested, and I ended up in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll quickly tell you about that experience. It was a very surreal place. I walked into a trailer, an old building behind a Taco Bell with that steps that went up in it, and there was a guy in front who was greeting, and he said his name was Ringo, and he said, I'm an alcoholic, and I thought, I'm embarrassed for you, dude. And I stepped in the room, and the furniture was all mixed-moshy, nothing matched. The people there were old, disheveled losers, as our first speaker talked about. A bunch of old, hairy, grumpy old farmers, it looked like. And it looked like they all had a cup of coffee in each hand and a cigarette hanging on each side of their mouth. In between puffs, they cursed. You know, it looked like a hayride for inbreds is what it looked like. I better watch out. I'm in Utah. I'm not judging you, but I'm getting close, aren't I? And I sat in the chair, and they started the meeting. They started all these readings like he did before the meeting here today. And I thought to myself, who are they kidding? This is church. This is church. They're probably going to pass a basket. You did. And they got to this thing, and the lady got up and started to talk. And I remember she said she was an alcoholic, and I thought, oh, my God, how embarrassing. And she started to tell her story, and she said things about herself that I thought were despicable. I couldn't believe that I was embarrassed for her, that she would talk about herself like that in front of people. I wouldn't want to think about those things, let alone say them out loud in front of people. And she told the story, and the story was she was an alcoholic. She had done heroin. She was a prostitute. And she talked about her boyfriend, her husband, dying in a car wreck. And then she started talking about being paroled and being back here to be of service for some. I had no clue what she was talking about. And she talked about her crime. And she said that she had gotten off work one night on a Wednesday night, and she went home to drink vodka like she always did. She poured herself some shots and started chugging down the vodka. And she put her two-year-old son in the bathtub in a blackout, forgot he was there, and he drowned. And I did exactly what you just did. I went, oh, my God, how miserable and pathetic. If I ever get as bad as hurt, I'll go to the AAA, too, you know. And what happened for me was the worst thing that can happen to an alcoholic of my type, untethered to a home group, to a program of action, to a sponsor. On my own, in the grips of alcoholism, the most dangerous thing that I could ever try to pull off is that I started to think. And in our book, it says that the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. And I am not an English major, but what that really means for me is this thing doesn't work very well. I have a mind that is tricky. I have a mind that is, it's fast. It thinks a lot. I'm a problem solver is what I am. I solve problems I don't start, but I work on them anyway. And I just, and just in case, you know, I have a mind that is offers me solutions that are worse than my initial problems. Right? Like the old adage, you know, I was too drunk to walk, so I drove. Yes, that's the mind. Everybody gets an A here. I have a mind that's, I have the ability to rationalize anything that I want to do. I have the ability that if I don't have any money and your wallet's laying there, I can convince myself that you really owe me a few bucks. This is the kind of mind that I have. Coupled with those things, Troy talked about it. There's a voice in my head. I don't know if anybody here in this room has a voice in their head or not. But if you're wondering whether or not you have a voice in your head, it just said, what voice? That's the voice. And it started talking. And what it said was, dude, you're not an alcoholic. You can't be an alcoholic. These people are talking about alcohol as a problem. That ain't no problem. Alcohol's not my problem. Alcohol's not my problem. It can't be my problem. How do you tell a kid who doesn't fit in very well, that goes to a high school party, who is not good at anything, I'm not liked, I'm not popular, I walk into a party where they're serving keg beer. Remember keg beer? Oh, yeah. You see her eyebrows go up? Ugh. The sweat drip down. They're serving keg beer, and I'm playing quarter with the cheerleaders. I'm talking to jocks. I'm singing Running with the Devil with a band. I can't do that not drinking, but I can do that when I'm drunk. Alcohol lets me do that. The problem is when I'm not drinking. That's the problem. And I get that early on, that this is an answer. I wouldn't have been able to say it that way. But I'm thinking about it, going, booze ain't my problem. And the delusional mind of the alcoholic says, the voice says, you're not an alcoholic, man. The problem isn't that you were drinking. The problem is you got caught. The solution is that you should do things that are more concealable than booze. It's a bust. You should do things you can put lots of amounts in a pocket and hide and put Visine in your eyes and no one will know. It won't smell on you. And so I started smoking non-addictive marijuana. Anybody else smoke any marijuana here? Anybody else smoke a lot of marijuana? This guy back here in the back, he said he probably smoked so much pot the zigzag man had a tattoo of you on his arm, right? I started taking those little pills with the X's on them. Remember those? The little white ones? Remember those? You take like four, you drink a quart of beer, it's before 40 ounces. Your hair dances a little. You wash your car about four times the same day. Get a little busy. I love those. They were called cross tops. It's pharmaceutical benz drink. It was good stuff. This is a time I lovingly call BT, before tweak. Yeah, BT. I bring that up. There's a treatment center that our home group does a lot of work in, as I understand you guys are doing, which I my hat's off to you. Thank you for doing that. But there's a treatment center that I go to, and we're getting a lot of kids coming in, younger and younger and younger, from better families that are just devastated behind methamphetamine. Just racked. I mean, just unbelievable. Some of the places they're coming from, and we're finding that a lot of these guys are alcoholics. Some of them aren't. And those we send on to the other 12-step program that works wonderful. That's our friend. And the ones that are alcoholic, we pull in and we start getting active in service. And I'd like to talk about that stuff because I know there are people that come to AA like I came to AA not knowing what I was. I had no clue what I was. How would I know what I was? I drank. You put something in front of me and I did it. Sometimes I did more of that than the drinking. I never really knew what I was when I got here. And I'm lucky to have read of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and discovered that this old book written in the 30s by a couple guys from Akron knew that I was coming. And if you're new tonight and you don't know whether you are a real alcoholic, I would invite you to read the first four chapters of our book, the first three chapters of our book, the first page of the fourth chapter, and answer the questions in there. And ask yourself some questions. This is what I was told to do. I was told to ask myself this. Did the writers think like I thought? Did they do what I do? Did they feel like I feel? Did they drink like I drank? And I was done. I got it. So I am just an alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned that I was an alcoholic in Alcoholics. I didn't know before I got here. I can tell you, though, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with a fervor to get sober at 91, I didn't get sober then, but I tried really hard. In 91, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was asked to share in a meeting, and I got to the podium, and I said, "My name is Chuck. I'm an alcoholic and a..." And this kind old man said, "Young man, you can share that way if you'd like here in AA, but you'll have to put in the basket twice." And I stopped that crap in a hurry. Out of respect for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and really with respect to the place you're in, it's just best to identify as what we are. We're alcoholics. And I'm doing this combination of stuff. I'm drinking. I get married really young because my girlfriend gets pregnant when I'm 18. And I do the right thing, and I married her, and I went to work full time, and I bought my first home at 19 years old. And my daughter is born into a loving home. She's born into a brand new tract house with three bedrooms. She's got a bedroom and a toy room. It's a nice, beautiful house. We got two cars in the garage and a big yard that's manicured nicely. We have terrific neighbors, and it's a wonderful, beautiful, loving, caring place. And I adore my daughter, and I love my wife. I know the experience of coming home to a fresh newborn or to a toddler and peeking over the crib at night and hearing that little music box play and that just that magic that happens when you're a parent, of being a parent. And I want that more than anything. But alcoholism doesn't care. It must be treated. And I didn't know that. And I know nothing about treating alcohol except that I drink to treat alcohol, because that's the treatment for alcoholism without the steps. I will work one program or I will work another. There will be no middle of the road for a guy like me. And I drink myself out of that marriage in about 2.5-3 years. And my wife leaves. And when she leaves, the wheels fall off because there's nobody there to do anything for anymore. I'm alone at night. I'm depressed. I'm self-pitying. And I am drinking around the clock. I work for this company back then called Anheuser-Busch. And they were tired of me. I wasn't making it to work. And that, you know, this is the decline of alcoholism. It's the adjust to the ride down. You know, I don't leave a three-bedroom. I don't leave a middle-class family where I was taught morals and values and end up being the street urchin that I become overnight. I do it a thing at a time. Just one more moral, one more thing at a time. I sell myself out. I'm in that house, and I can't make it to work, which is just scumbag stuff to me. That losers can't make. I work no matter what. I was taught the ethic of working. I can't do it. And they're going to fire me, and they send me to my first treatment center at 22 years old, a place in Clovis, a place called the Ark. It's a 30-day dryout. I went there for 30 days. They had the steps there. They had the traditions there. They had sponsors there. They had meetings coming in. everything that I would need to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body called alcoholism, and I want nothing to do with any of it. I just want to get my job back and go on my merry way. Thank you very much. And I left that place on a Friday night convinced that I would never drink again with everything in me, believing, thinking, saying, believing that I won't drink again, knowing I'm not going to drink again, and within 4 hours I'm in a liquor store. In about 4 months, I go where the tough guys of the world go, Mama's couch. And, I lost the house. I lost everything I owned, and I'm waking up on that couch every day convinced that I won't do it today, and every day is like the same as was yesterday. Every day is the same. I make myself promises. I write checks I can't cash. I start writing their checks. I start taking their stuff, and I hate myself. I can't make it to noon or 1 o'clock without doing something. I got to get it off of me. And living like that long enough, what starts to happen is I start to hate myself for watching my parents suffer the way they do. It's a small town they live in, and they're disgraced all the time by me. And I'm unemployable. And it just gets worse and worse. And I start to get to the point where I don't like myself at all. And I just wish I could go back to wherever it was before I was born and call it over. And one of the things that really was pushing the button on that one was at this time, my daughter must be about 4 years old. And I have visitation on the weekends. I get her every other weekend on Friday night, and her mom picks her back up on Sunday night. And it's a court order, so they try to fill that up, and they bring my daughter over to my mom's house, her grandma's house, on a Friday night around 6 o'clock. Her mom gets off work, runs her over to the house, drops her off, and I'm not there. And my daughter waits for me in the window out front, and when she hears a car door or she hears a horn or any kind of a noise, she gets up in the window excited because Daddy's here. And her grandma says stuff like, "Honey, I don't think he's going to be able to make it because I think he's busy at work, trying to cover up for me." And my little daughter, you know, with all the innocence of a four-year-old, says, no, this time he's going to be here. He promised. We're going to the zoo this weekend. This weekend it's Chuck E. Cheese. And she does this the entire weekend, all weekend long. She don't want to go anywhere because Daddy's coming, and she don't want to miss it when he gets there. And sometime Sunday afternoon, I show up. I haven't slept. I'm unkept. I'm broke. I'm in bad shape. I come running up to the door, begging my mom for $5 in the car keys so I can take Tiffany to McDonald's so we can have one more guilt Happy Meal. So I can tell her how next week this will be different. I promise this time, honey. And that didn't happen once or twice. It happened week after week after week after week. Not because I didn't love her. Not because I didn't care about her, not because she didn't matter, because I have alcoholism. And I didn't know that. And I hated myself more to the point where I was getting suicidal. A buddy of mine had moved to L.A., and I was ready to check out. And he moved to L.A., and I thought, you know, if I went to Los Angeles, I'd get away from alcohol and drugs forever. It was a good plan. And that's the thinking that I have. And I wanted to come to L.A. And the other thing that was really prodded me to go to L.A. was I was dating this gal, and she was pregnant. And that's the kind of guy that I am. I'm not a noble man. I'm not a good man with values. I'm here not by virtue at all. I'm here because of failure. I'm here because of living with me and the choices that I make and the people that I hurt. And I ran from that gal. I jumped in the car, moved to L.A. with my buddy. I left her there. Her stomach was sticking out. She was counting on me, and I split. I split and would hope it would go away like a traffic warrant. And my son was born in August of 88. I'm living in L.A. I'm living in Brentwood in this fancy place. I'm making a lot of money. I'm drinking badly, but I'm holding it together. I'm in one of those periods where I'm able to kind of pull it off for a while. The book talks about it. And I go up to see my son when he's about 4 months old. He had a medical condition, and I went to go see him. And it was the first time I saw him, and I looked into his eyes, and I looked at his mom and her eyes, and I thought, you know what, I got to grow up. This is a bunch of crap. I got to man up here. It's time to take care of business. And I said, honey, get your stuff. You're coming with me. I'm moving you to L.A. And she loaded up her stuff, and we moved to Los Angeles. We lived in this one-bedroom condo or apartment in Brentwood. Brentwood's a very, very upper crust neighborhood. It's a nice neighborhood. It's about $1.5 million difference from where I live now. and I moved to Brentwood with her. We were there till the rent was due. Because she has alcoholism. She has what I have. And if you're a woman alcoholic in this room and you've been through that book and you know those steps, I hope to God you're endeavoring to carry that to another young lady walking in these rooms. I hope you're trying really hard because she isn't here yet. And I hope you take care of her when she gets here because I promise you something. If yours come to me, I will do my best to help them. And I ask the same from you. And her and I are really sick. We're the alcoholic couple that you might see at a clubhouse or a home group. You watch us. We walk in. We always tell lies. We're always full of crap. We always talk about our kids. We always try to borrow it from you because our kid needs something. You'll see us in front of the grocery store panhandling to buy Isomil or Similac when really we want to get drunk because we're both sick and we need to get well. This is the kind of people we are. And I'm going to paint for you the picture of progression. At 24 years old, I had a three-bedroom house, two cars in the garage, and a nice, beautiful home. I told you about that. At 25, 26 years old, I got a son living in a one-bedroom, a bedroom in a guy's house that we rent who doesn't eat half the time. He sleeps in a laundry basket with towels, and we don't take care of him. He wears T-shirts for diapers, and we don't pay attention. We're not there. He's got nobody looking out for him. And I can't do anything for him. And I didn't plan it for it to be that way. But that's the progression of alcoholism. It just gets worse and never better. I don't care what it looks like for a while. I don't care what job I have, what school I'm going to. It's coming around the corner. The downfall, it's even worse. It always, always happens for guys like me. And I got arrested in 1991. And that's what started my journey to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's one of those little elements in the cement that started this thing. I got arrested, and I got diverted into a diversion program. They were talking about giving me state prison for a bunch of, like, petty crimes. I'm not a criminal. I'm not a tough guy. And I'm terrified of prison. That scares me. I'm not a big guy, if you see. I'm like an hors d'oeuvre in prison, you know. I'll be calling some guy Papa, you know. I'm from L.A., but I don't swing that way. You know, I'm from North Hollywood, not West Hollywood. But if you do, that's cool. We got no beef for that. I got no beef for that at all. But I'm just not that way. So I'm scared. I don't know what to do. And I go to court. And they give me this diversion thing. Diversion's cool in California. You go to these classes on Saturday. You pay $25 a week. You go to classes, and then at the end of 6 months, they throw your case out, and the case is expunged, and you're free to go. It's cool. And so I took diversion, and I'm going to diversion. The only problem with diversion is this little test that they have on there. It's a test that's plagued me my entire life called a urinalysis. And I don't know how to pee clean. I don't know how to do it. And so I'm terrified, and I'm trying to do what I had heard in 12-step meetings for years because I've been to a lot of fellowships by this time. And they all had a common thing they would all seem to say. They would all say, just don't drink no matter what. Just don't drink no matter what. Have you ever heard that in a meeting? Just don't drink. It sounds campy. It's very nice. Unfortunately, telling someone like me, just don't drink no matter what, it's like telling somebody with projectile diarrhea, wear white and don't go. That'll get messy. You like the picture, the vision on that one, don't you? But it sounds, what they're not telling me is this. What they should be telling me is this. Chuck, go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't drink in between the meetings. Get a sponsor that you call and follow direction from. Read the book. Start taking the step and help others. Pray to a God. Do these things over here so you won't have to do what you're already going to do. Because an alcoholic like me must drink. There is no maybe. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. I'm going to drink again without some sort of a solution. Our book talks about it over and over and over in those first few chapters. For reasons yet obscure, the alcoholic is unable at certain times to bring into his consciousness with sufficient force the suffering and the humiliation of even a week or a month ago. I'm without defense against the first drink. I've lost power of choice. The baffling feature of alcoholism, as we know it, the utter inability to leave it alone. I'm powerless. Powerless. It's not... what it sounds like. When I was new, I thought powerless is, I put my hands on her again. I didn't go to work again. I got picked up again. No, 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 no. Drunk. That's being drunk. Powerlessness is this. It makes me do what I don't want to do, including it sober. It makes me do it when I am sober. Anybody here have 30 days before and drink again? Anybody here have 30 days and drink again? There's living proof of it right there. Because if being sober was the answer, I wouldn't be back again. I would just be sober for good. But I'm an alcoholic and I must drink without a program of action. I didn't know that. I picked up a drink after 4 days of not drinking, no matter what. I drank no matter what, and I ended up in a mental hospital, 5150 in California. It means you're a danger to yourself or others, and I ended up in a psych ward. And while I was there, something happened for me that changed my life, I believe, forever. And what had happened for me, and it didn't happen right away, but it was planted. The seed was planted. While I was there, members of hospitals and institutions came out that night. Anybody here doing H&I? Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for my life. Thank you for on the night that you thought the ball game was more important, that work was more important, that you needed time with your kids, that you needed some alone time. Thank you for making Alcoholics Anonymous a priority. Thank you for going into a place that you knew nobody was going to hear you because I heard you. And this man came out that night. He was a man of service. And he talked about this thing. Really what he talked about was a third step when I boil it down. He knew the meaning of that step, since we're on threes tonight. He talked about this thing, about this being relieved, the bondage of self, his difficulties being removed, so he could be of maximum service to others, so he could be a witness to those he would help, of God's power, God's love, and this way of life. And the man sat down in a chair, and he started talking about his alcoholism, and he said he was different, separate, lonely, and apart his whole life. He said he had a hole in his soul that he couldn't fill with anything he could touch or see. It was an inside job. He talked about being a loser and a coward, about the kind of miserable son he was and the awful father he was. And he said, I don't even know how to be a man. And I knew he knew. He knew. Nobody had ever talked that way. I never heard it. Maybe I did an AA, but I wasn't listening. That night I'm listening. And he talked about being sober and Alcoholics Anonymous 5 years and being back in school. And that didn't impress me. What impressed me was he talked about his daughter and how he spent time with her. And at this time in my life, I don't know where my kids are at. And I fell apart. And I don't know why, but the voice in my head clicked, and it said, clear as a bell, it said, Chuck, you're just like this guy. Maybe if you do what he's doing, maybe you won't have to live the way you're living. And I believe that's the essence of step two, is that I came to believe that something might be able to help me. That's really what that step is saying. And I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me to do that. And I went to meetings twice and three times a day on the weekends. I became a meeting maker. I know you guys hear meeting makers make it. Wrong answer. Not true. Meeting makers stay here long enough to get really sick and infect the crowd. That's what happens to people like me. I'm going to lots of meetings. I'm not doing anything. It's very important to go to lots of meetings. Very important to be going to lots of meetings. But just going to meetings and just going to meetings only, nothing changes. There's nothing going on in my life. I bought a big book and didn't read it. I didn't take any steps. I didn't get a sponsor. I don't like being told what to do. And not realizing when they say, put your hands on the car, you're being told what to do. I'm not going to take any commitments because I ain't going to be here very long. My friend Louis says it best. He says, no sponsor, no service. No steps, no chance. No service, no sponsor, no steps, no chance for a guy like me. And I was here enjoying the fruits and benefits of step number none in a happy land called sobriety. And I don't know about you, but when you take the drink away from me and you put me around people who are sober, who are getting well, that are actually doing stuff, people I hate in AA are getting better than I am. It torques my personality a little bit, you know. And I start to develop mental illness as I get away from the drink. Alcoholism starts where the bag and the bottle end for me. The wearing down of the mind and that just insatiable insaneness that I run through, that I got a drink to stop it. And I become mentally ill in AA. I develop conditions like dry polar, you know. I need something, you know. And I end up taking a drink at 6 months and 7 days of that. I had 6 months and 7 days without a drink, and I picked a drink up because that's what I do. And it wasn't where I left off, like the book says. It was much, much worse. I have an insatiable thirst now that I can't quench, and I'm drinking badly, and I'm getting worse, and I'm going to meetings, 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 and I'm asking God for help, and the help ain't coming. And I know what it's like to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous again and again and again and not be able to be sober. I know what that's like. I know what it's like to walk in and have well-intentioned people walk up to you and say stuff like, "Are you done yet?" As if it's a moral decision that I've made to do this to myself. As if I like living in the toilet. I know what it's like to be shunned at, looked down on, ignored. I know what that's like by people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I also know what it's like to be around people who know our traditions and that know the steps and always do stuff like this. Here's a cup of coffee, kid. Come on in. We love you. Welcome back. I know what that's like. I know what it's like to have people believe in you or believe in this process more than they care about how sick I am. And I was lucky enough to be around those kinds of people. And I... On June the 14th, 1993, I woke up from a run. It wasn't the worst run ever. It's just the one that, like Larry says, drank away the debate whether I was going to do what you do. And I think for all intents and purposes, without knowing it, I did step three that day because the decision wasn't something I came up with. The options were all exhausted. There was nowhere else to turn except to do what you do. There was nowhere else to go. Because here's the deal. The only thing that ever worked for me, that ever made me comfortable around you, that made me fit in my own skin, the only thing that ever made me ready to be around anybody and feel good, which was drinking or taking stuff, it ain't giving me any relief. I'm drinking and I'm crying and I'm crying uncontrollably. I'm wondering what's wrong with me. I'm alone all the time and I hate myself even more when I'm drunk and I can't stand being dry. And when you live like that, and you're in those two, that spot, you're fodder for Alcoholics Anonymous. You're ready. And I begged to God I didn't believe in for help, and I ended up picking up the phone and calling this little Jewish guy. His name was Art Miller. God rest his soul. And Art picked me up, and he asked me a question. He said, "Are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober, kid?" And I said, "Yeah, sure I am." And he said, "I want you to check into a detox." I said, "Oh, no, not that." And he hung up. And I thought about my options and I didn't have any. There was nothing left but to pick up the spiritual tools that you had been laying at my feet for years and years and years. And you would lay them in front of me and I would kick them away and go, "Oh, no, I got to get her back. Oh, no, I got to get that job. Oh, no, I got to work harder. Oh, no, I got to go to school." I did that over and over and over again. And on that morning, there was nothing left. And I called him back and said, "Okay." And he came to get me, and he picked me up, and he had some water. He cleaned me up. Weighed 126 pounds. I had hair down to here, and I was urinating colors because my kidneys were in bad shape. And he said something to me I'll never forget. He told me that I was an alcoholic of the hopeless. He pronounced me an alcoholic. He said, "Kid, you're an alcoholic of the hopeless variety." He said, "You're going to die drunk. You're going to die an alcoholic death." And I looked at him and he said, "You're going to die with a spike hanging out of your arm. You're going to die choking on your own vomit." He said, "Kid, when you finally do die, everybody that you've ever loved, had any care for, respect for, they'll be relieved you're finally gone." I thought, "I'm having a bad day here. You got to lay that on me, you know? I mean..." He said, "You have a really bad attitude. I've been watching you for a long time, and I don't let people talk to me that way. I got a little bit of Irish in me. I don't put up with that. And I don't know why, but out of my mouth came the words I don't say." My father was in the military. I had a lot of resentments toward military people, military life, jarheads. I hated anything military. I hated it. And I hated the stuff they made me say as a kid, so I refused to say it. But on that morning, out of my mouth, with nobody telling me to do it, I said, "Yes, sir. Yes, sir." And on that day, I became willing to do whatever that little guy told me to do. And he got me busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. He got me active. He taught me how to be a member of AA. And not a bystander. He taught me to get in the middle of this thing, to show up early, stay late, to take commitments, to go out and do service work. And we started doing a lot of work together. We were going to hospitals and institutions and psych wards and detoxes and stuff early on. And it did something for me, man. It connected me with you, and it made me hunger for more of AA. And we started taking the steps out of the 12x12. That's the way he did it. And I love the 12x12. Please don't hear this wrong. I adore I love what the 12x12 has in it. But the 12x12 alone is insufficient. In my experience, not my opinion, my experience is the 12x12. The 12x12 is, it's kind of like the big book in the 12x12. The 12x12, if you're a builder, you'll get to this. The builder, the big book is the concrete foundation, or the subfloor. It is the framework. It is the roof. It is the walls. The 12 and 12 is the carpets, the drapes. It's the crown molding. It's the nice windows. It's the nice stuff that I add to, not instead of. And I didn't have that. I had the 12 and 12. And I love my first sponsor. He gave me what he had, and he loved me a lot. And he got me where I needed to be when the time came. But I'm going to tell you something. At 5.5, 6 years sober, my business is conning people out of large sums of money. My business is stealing, really, is what it is. I'm not living morally. I'm doing things in Alcoholics Anonymous that nobody knows about. I'm sitting in meetings rotting in my chair because you're talking about honesty and stuff, and I don't have any of that. I know what it's like to sit in the rooms and smile and act nice and throw a couple of keep coming backs in, and then really to myself thinking, oh my God, look at me, feeling worse and worse and worse. And then I start judging everybody around me because I don't want to look at me, right? You might see it yourself where you go into a discussion room and somebody walks in and you think, oh, she's going to share about that relationship again. Oh, well, he's going to talk about his job, right? Oh, there he is, Mr. Gratitude, you know. I start judging everybody because I don't want to look at me. I don't want to look. And at 6.5 years sober like this, I'm at the place where I had been drinking. I'm at the place where I want to check out a hotel life. I'm waking up in the morning, and I'm not asking God what I can do for the man who's still sick. What I'm asking God for is the courage to reach into the highboy and pull out the pistol and call it a day, because there's something really wrong with me, and I can't put my finger on it. There ain't enough money. There ain't enough anything to make me feel okay, and I hate myself. And I'm not even drinking, and I'm an AA. And I'm active, don't you know? What's wrong? And I heard my sponsor talk at a conference a little while before that, and I remember hearing this guy. And this was a guy with an answer. I couldn't refute it. And I went looking for him. And I was working in Las Vegas quite a bit. In fact, we know each other from Vegas as well. And I knew that this guy that I'm talking about, my sponsor, lived in Vegas, but I didn't really know who he was. And I had his name, and I went looking for him, and I found him, and I started following him around Las Vegas and around California, wherever he spoke, listening to him because he made sense. And I finally asked him to sponsor me, and he started taking me through the Big Book. Page by page, step by step, a real honest third step, a real fourth step, not one of them psychobabble guidebook things from someplace out of Minnesota, not one of those, the real deal. And if you did one of those, I got no beef with it. I'm just telling you that I had no change. I had no change. Nothing had changed. No view had changed. I hated everybody the same. I had the same crap going on inside of myself. And I was dying miserably here in Alcoholics Anonymous sober. And Bob taught me to write down, I'm resentful at my dad. Why? Because he abused me. Lie, fancied, not real. Not real at all. I'm resentful at my dad for the way he mistreated me, for the way he made me work, for the way he ridiculed me in front of my friends. All this kind of stuff here. What did it affect? Everything. Everything. And then there's a little part in there that we miss a lot. It doesn't say where is my part or anything, but there's a section of this where it says that I realized the people who wronged me were perhaps spiritually sick. Could I do what they did? Could I on a bad day do what they did? I'm a guy that makes lines in the sand and always crosses them. I could do anything under the grips of selfishness. And I started to see my father differently. What I saw looking at my dad is I realized this guy had alcoholic brothers. They were always in and out of the penitentiary or nut house. He wasn't like that. They were losers. And he saw his son acting the same exact way. And there were periods where he kind of put the muscles down a little bit on me because he didn't want to see his only son, his baby boy, turn out like his brothers had turned out. It changed, and I felt awful. I felt miserable for the way I had judged him. And then the book asks, where was I to blame? It does not say, what is my part? My part implies that he did something, and we are talking about the resentment specifically. What are the defects of character that if God would remove, the resentment would be gone? And I could take that stuff into 6 and 7. And I was in this business, and I couldn't leave. I wouldn't leave. I kept staying there doing the thing, and I was going broke. I wasn't closing deals. I knew how to do the job, but I couldn't close deals anymore. And I went to Bob, and we were doing 6 and 7. I was asking God to remove the defects of character in this thing. And I ended up going broke. I ended up borrowing from my friends, and I would not leave. I stayed on afraid. And I kept asking what he told me to do. Because I don't remove the defects. I don't work on the defects. I ask God for help. It's his job to remove them. And one day I'm at work and the FBI came running in the building with these 9mm submachine gun things and headsets, and the defective character was removed. Root and branch. Which was a long trial, and then I started making amends. And I don't have enough time to talk about it, but my amends, the amends were frightening to me. Money, showing my face, work. And I'm here to tell you, if you're new, the amends have been one thing for me only, one thing only. They've been here to help me mend the tear in the fabric of the relationships, which in turn has left me free. It's left me free. Because of the amends, I have a career today. I have my own business. Because of the amends, my kids are in my life today. Because of the amends, my family looks to me sometimes when they're having trouble. I'm the outcast, the embarrassment that they'll call and say, what do you think? Because of the amends, my life. Because of the amends, this foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous started on June 10th, 1935. Bob went out and made amends for the first time, and this thing changed. The amends free me. They're not here to harm me. They're here to free me. They're here because I have the kind of mind that I could be driving home. I could be driving home feeling pretty good, and all of a sudden my head starts throwing stuff at me that I've done. It makes me crazy. And you know what the amends are about? The amends are about the other voice going, wait a minute, we paid that back. Wait a minute, we went to go visit them. Wait a minute, we were there for this. Wait a minute. It's a counteraction, and it also helps me not to further myself into the hole. And I try to take regular inventory, and I do a lot of stuff with Step 11, which is very open to a lot of different things, and try to take care of and pamper and create and enlarge this relationship with the power that has changed my life through Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have I'd like to believe that I spend most of my time doing what my sponsor has taught me to do and has showed me to do, which is trying to help others. In our book, over and over and over and over, this concept of putting my hand out, of helping others, of self-sacrifice comes into the picture over and over again. It's mentioned so many times in the book. If I had a book, I'd just go through it and show you. It's incredible how much of this helping others is there. That's the magic here, is an alcoholic reaching out to another for the purpose of recovery and trying. And as a result, we've built a home group. We have a group like this one, lots of young folk, strong group with lots of people coming up on 2, 3 years, 7 years, who are sponsoring people, whose problems have dissolved and disappeared because they don't feed them anymore. They're starved out because they're too busy feeding other people's solutions. You never notice that when you sponsor somebody, they get a sponsee, they quit calling with problems. You ever know? It's a strange thing. If you're new tonight, I want to invite you to do something. I want to invite you to follow people that follow the book. I want to invite you to follow people that follow the book and be so kind as to stay here and pass on what you've given to me. What you've given to me is life. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope you come back to lots of meetings. I want you to know that it looks hard, but it's really not. It's very simple. A price must be paid, but there are people around here that will always and have always walked me along. I've always had the help I needed here. I've always had the guiding hand, and I've always felt love and compassion in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank you for my life, and thank you for letting me share.